Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Truth Pursuit. This is going to be awesome. I am so excited for this. This is an idea that I proposed to Corey a few weeks ago, and it has developed into what we think is going to be a great segment for the podcast. Tonight's inaugural topic for this segment is going to be a little bit longer than the segment will typically run during an ISM show. Maybe it'll run 5-10 minutes, but tonight we're going to try and go 30-35 minutes just to have a little fun with it. And for tonight's inaugural topic, since it's going to be longer, we thought that we would have a little fun with it. So what could be more fun than the flood of Noah? My idea for this segment is to bring up a topic weekly on the ISM show that we can interact with the audience on, that I can interact with the audience on Twitter and Periscope throughout the week. So we're not going to really be delving into it typically during the week when we have a show. I mean, we'll talk a little bit about it, but I just want to bring up the topic and then just engage with the audience throughout the week on Twitter, getting thoughts and arguments for, arguments against, any ideas, memes, whatever. Just have fun with it. And that's what we're going to do tonight. You can follow me at El Deuterino, ELDUDEIRENO on Twitter and Periscope. That's all caps. You can follow Corey at Dopinephrine. Follow the show on Twitter and Periscope at ISMPodcast_. And you can listen live on blogtalkradio.com/informpodcast. Tonight's episode is not on Periscope, but our usual shows on Wednesday nights are always broadcast on there. If you would like to contribute to the show, please do so at patreon.com/informpodcast. Tonight's show is not being charged. Only the two-hour Wednesday episode will be charged. The show always airs at 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 Central, 6 Mountain, which is 5 on the West Coast, Wednesdays on Blog Talk Radio. All episodes are available on iTunes for download or streaming. If you want to call us up and be on the air, phone number is 646-564-9551. So, I'm excited about this. Let's get right into it. Corey, how are you doing tonight?
I am doing fantastic. This is such a brilliant idea. When you first brought this up, I was really excited at the prospects of it. And then to actually have the opportunity to work with you more consistently as the co-host is also, of course, very, very exciting. I think this is going to be a really, really neat way to kind of extend outside of just the two-hour Wednesday show, but to actually engage with people beyond that as you do Periscopes and tweet some things throughout the rest of the week. I think this is a fantastic opportunity for our audience, and it's going to be a lot of fun moving forward.
Oh, I'm absolutely stoked for it. I had a lot of fun when I first got on Twitter, and the secular community on Twitter is just fantastic, and I learned so much over the last like 3 years on there, and been trying to find a way to get back involved, because with the things that I've been doing recently, I've kind of not Periscoped as much recently or not been tweeting as much. And I really wanted to get back into it. And I thought, how do I get in there with some kind of a plan and some kind of a goal? And then when this opportunity to co-host with you came up, and I appreciate it from the bottom of my heart. I am honored to be on the show permanently now. And I just want to have some fun. So, I want to bring up these topics, have some discussions. If people can answer questions that I don't know, that'd be great. Send me those. If you have more questions that maybe I could answer, ask those. If you just want to put memes, put those. But tonight we're going to talk about Noah's flood.
And it's so much fun. Noah's flood.
I suppose it's not his flood. He was just in it. God's
right.
Flood.
God's flood, really. Yeah, technically.
But, I guess we'll just hop right into it here. Noah's flood takes place in Genesis, chapters 6 through 9. Carries that narrative, and there's a lot of information in there about it. And it seems to us counter-apologists and secular-minded people that a lot of it doesn't add up. A lot of it just doesn't seem possible.
To say the least, the amount of problems here, I actually had some fun because we talk a lot with people, as you were saying, in the secular community, in the atheist community, in the free thinking community, at least the small one that we have located and been members of on various social media platforms. And I've talked to I don't know how many people who Noah's Ark gave them their first introduction to doubt. Some of the cleverest skeptics I've ever met can trace all the way back to, well, I was 9 years old and I went to Sunday school and they told us about Noah's flood. Noah's Ark and the flood sent by God. And I started asking questions and they couldn't really answer them. The mind of a child is a remarkable thing. It's odd that a childhood is where your imagination is flourishing. It's where these magical ideas of fantastic events can really be fostered. And yet it's the critical thinking of a young person going, wait a minute. All of this water showed up and there's an ark. What now? Animals on it. That's when the seeds of doubt begin to be born. Some of my closest colleagues in the secular world can trace their skeptic tendencies all the way back to their introduction to this particular story.
Your co-host on the recent Obama episode is one of those.
Yep. That's when Chuck at Jotnar, friend of the show, he talks about being in Sunday school at like 10 or 12 and going, Wayne, this is some bullshit.
Well, I guess maybe before we start, there might be some people who just don't know about Noah's Flood. Now, I know that seems not very probable. Most people know, unless you've been stranded on an ark out to sea for several years, you should have probably heard about this. But the basic gist of it is God was upset, wanted to kill everybody on the planet, wipe out his creation, decided that Noah and his family were good enough to be spared, and allowed for them to take a few of the animals that were on the planet, a few of each kind of animals that were on the planet with them, so that they could all repopulate from their goodness, their wholesomeness, after the waters had subsided. So he orders Noah to build an ark, sends animals to Noah when it's completed, and they climb on and off they go. As I said, it takes place Genesis 6 through 9. And in Genesis 6:15, there's the actual measurements of the ark. Let me just read that here. It says, and this is from the Holy Bible, King James Version Dictionary Study Bible. And it says, and this is the fashion which thou shalt make it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits. The breadth of it shall be 50 cubits, and the height of it 30 cubits. Now, if you aren't familiar with the measurement of a cubit, it's a measurement that was used in a lot of ancient cultures around that time. And it is the length from the bottom of your elbow to the tip of your middle finger. So it's going to vary person to person. I used the measurement of mine, which is like 19 and a half, and I just kind of rounded it to 20 inches. And so that makes the ark 500 feet long and 83 feet wide. Could you, Corey, give us a little perspective, like a couple other ships that the size of them, so we can maybe see that in our minds?
Sure. Yeah. When we're dealing with cubits, you're dealing with this antiquated measurement. I love, by the way, that you took the time to measure your own arm. That never once did that occur to me to actually, I just Googled how long is a cubit. I love that. I should have, I don't know why that didn't occur to me, but in any case, the ark is about 500 feet long. when we're talking about how big that sounds pretty big. 500 feet, that's pretty impressive. And that would have been especially remarkable, 4,000 years ago.
Yes.
In order to get this in your heads, the Titanic, classic example of a big ship, was 883 feet long. So about 380 feet longer than the Ark, and an aircraft carrier used by the U.S. Navy today. The standard aircraft carrier used by the United States is 1,092 feet long, a little more than two arcs, nose to nose. An aircraft carrier is still longer than two arcs.
Okay, so this is a pretty big ship, 500 feet long. Now, just right off the bat, I think I'm running into trouble with, I'm thinking about an aircraft carrier, and they're pretty big. You can get quite a few jet fighters on them, some helicopters, crews of a couple thousand, I imagine. I don't know exactly, but I'm not sure that two of every kind of animal would fit on it.
My gut says no. Yeah, that you can get a couple of thousand. When the Titanic went down, hundreds of people survived that, but it took over 1,500 people with it into the depths. So you can fit, and that's smaller than an aircraft carrier. I think you can get like 80 jets on an aircraft carrier. You can fit a lot of people on there. But if we're going to talk about two of every kind of animal, good God, that's, I mean, you can't even hardly represent a number that large. Now, from what I understand, there are apologists who say that they only needed two of every type. Have you heard this argument?
I have.
It falls apart a little bit immediately because, and I don't want to jump ahead too much. I'm interjecting a little bit here, but at one point we end up talking about both ravens and doves.
Right.
So at least he's not. It's not like he just took two birds. Obviously, there's a difference between doves and ravens. Somebody did the math, and I've gone and foolishly not kept it in front of me. We're still talking about thousands of types of animals, and somebody cleverer than I did the math on insects and said that if you were to break it down to kind, you'd still be looking at about 2 million species of insects.
Yeah, I mean, just insects alone. And you're running into space problems. But these ships that we're talking about that we're comparing the size to, these are the Titanic and aircraft carriers. These are modern ships. These are iron and steel. And the Ark was a wooden ship. Gopher wood, I believe, is what Genesis says it is made out of.
Yeah,
and,
gopher.
The largest wooden ship ever built was the Wyoming. It's named after the state that we live in, Corey.
Good luck there.
Governor Bryant Butler Brooks was one of the investors for the ship, which cost about $175,000 when it was built in 1909. It was overall length of... let me just get this here, 450 feet long, and it was 50 feet wide. Now, this was built in 1909 when they had pretty much mastered wooden shipbuilding.
Sure.
I mean, these were the best at it. And the problem that the Wyoming had, and it's going to be hard to kind of visualize this, you're hearing this audio, but the Wyoming was so long that it would twist port to starboard, like the stern would twist to the starboard as the bow would, the bow would twist to the port, and it would twist back and forth, and this would cause gaps in the 6-inch plankings, and then those gaps would rush with water, and the crew would have to pump water out constantly. And so to try and fix this, they put in a number of iron crossbeams to try and support it. Something like, let me just find it here, 80 crossbeams, angle iron to try and keep it from twisting. And You know, it served for a few years, 1909 to 1924. But on March 11th, 1924, it sank. It came apart, broke apart, and sank, and a crew of 14 was lost. Now, this was a ship, the largest wooden ship ever built by master shipbuilders, and it was too big. It was too big for a wooden ship, and they recognized it, and they tried to reinforce it with iron, and it still wouldn't hold together.
So they had the benefit of, first off, metal. They could use metal to reinforce this. They also had pumps in order to pump that water out. None of these technologies, of course, existed during the days of the Ark.
Right. And the Ark is 50 feet longer than the Wyoming. So right here, I'm running into some troubles already.
You know, have you heard about this this tablet? It's at the, I think it's at the British Museum. It's a cuneiform tablet, much older than the Book of Genesis. It's from the Mesopotamia regions. And in the guy that somebody from the public, their father had this. He brought it home like during World War II, I think. I don't know where he got it, but this guy came and brought it to a scientist. He's one of the few experts on the planet today who can understand cuneiform, because it's, you know, a dead text. Nobody uses it anymore. But this person does understand it. And so this person figured out that it was cuneiform, brought it to this expert, gave it to him. It's now in the British Museum, and it's been authenticated by several researchers. It details something very, very similar to the Ark story, just on this little, it's kind of like, it looks like a brick, and somebody pressed, probably, you know, like when it was soft clay, somebody pressed using cuneiform all of this text into this brick. And it basically describes a similar story to the flood story. And it includes very specific instructions on how to build the Ark. In fact, much more specific than Genesis gives us. It has more measurements. It talks about how much pitch will be needed. It talks about how much rope will be needed. And it very clearly describes the Ark as being round. In Mesopotamia and the surrounding regions at the time, they would make these, think of a shallow basket. They would weave them out of like rope, almost like flax, and they would wrap them around a wooden like a skeleton. They would wrap this rope all around it very, very, very tightly, and then paint it with pitch. And then you could like sit in that like a bowl, and you could get a paddle, and you would use that for crossing the rivers and whatnot. This brick seems to suggest that the original, one of the older, rather, I shouldn't say original, one of the older Ark stories actually says it should be massive, like Noah's Ark is claimed to have been, but that it needed to have been completely round.
Oh, that is interesting. I hadn't heard that before. I've heard of it depicted as like rectangle, like just a long box. As a matter of fact, that's the way it was depicted in the latest Noah movie.
The Darren Aronofsky flick. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I suppose that the round one would maybe fare better in the twisting department, but I don't know how big of a bowl you would need to put two of every kind of animal in.
And if you had a giant bowl, then you're obviously, I mean, that means that Genesis is wrong. Genesis does not describe a bowl. Genesis describes something
exactly
rectangular.
I just kind of wanted to bring up a few points so that we can have things to talk about during the week. And so one of the ones is right in the beginning of the story, in Genesis 6, 1-6, it speaks of the sons of God, and that they were attracted to the daughters of men. And that they would mate with them and have children. And this was like sort of the starting of bringing about the wickedness that God was upset with. And it says in Genesis 6:4, there were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men which were of old, men of renown. Giants, Corey.
Straight up giants, man.
I wonder what made a giant in biblical times, because as far as I knew, in biblical times, weren't people much shorter in stature than they are now?
Much shorter. The historical record and anthropology tells us as much. Man has grown taller mostly because man has gotten healthier. Humans of antiquity were more or less the same. I mean, species-wise, they were identical. They would have had the same DNA and, you know, five fingers on each hand, and everything else would have been the same. But they were much shorter. Part of that was due to good old-fashioned malnutrition. But yeah, humans in general in this time period, I've heard as low as 4 feet would have been an average person, an average adult, up to maybe scraping around the 4'10" area, perhaps a little bit taller. A giant, I think, might be somebody our height. If we could go back and meet Noah, we might have been seen as giants.
That's very true. Yeah. And this just brought something else to mind that I don't even know why I didn't think of it earlier, but that would make for much shorter cubits.
Oh, my goodness. You are absolutely right.
So you may have a smaller ship that might not have the problem with the twisting, but then you're going to have a bigger problem with fitting the animals. So they're going to have to pick their poison here on how that goes.
That's a brilliant observation.
It just came to my head just now as we were talking about it. Now, speaking of cubits, though, Genesis 7:20 says that, you know, when the water started and it started to rain and the ark's lifting up, or as you told me earlier, that maybe it just stayed under for a while and then popped up later like a fish bobber or something, that at a certain point it rose another 15 cubits or 25 feet and covered the mountains. And that's when everything was at last covered. And you had mentioned something about that when I was talking about that earlier today. What was that?
Well, okay, we are talking about water. Water is something that we are familiar with. Water, if you pour it into a container, will calibrate. It'll even out. It'll fill its container in an even way, right? This is like middle school. It'll stay. It has an even depth. So if you are covering the tallest mountains on Earth by an extra so many feet, then the water is going to be uniformly deep relative to its surface. You're going to have places where the distance between the top of the mountain and the surface of the water is not very much, but it's going to be the water is going to be evenly deep from sea level, let's say. So you've got water globally that is taller than the tallest mountains. We're talking somewhere in the ballpark of about 20,000 feet above sea level. That's like a low flying airplane. For what is it, half a year, a full year after the flood that it's floating around, it's going to be in the clouds. It's going to be floating where Boeing jets are flying in a part of the atmosphere where there is much less oxygen and it's very, very cold. Everything on the ark would have either frozen or asphyxiated.
Interesting. It seems that a lot of these problems that we run into, the only workaround for them is magic, because God
has to be God. Yeah, it has to be the magic, the magical powers of God.
Okay, and fast forward a bit to Genesis 8:5, talking about the mountaintops. As the waters started to recede, the mountaintops became visible in Genesis 8:5. Now, presumably that Noah would have had to have seen that, in order for it to be recorded, or it's just God telling us that this is what happened because there's nobody else around. So if it was farther than 14 miles away, I think is the curvature, then he's not going to see it. And how would he know that the mountains are now visible?
Mm.
But what he did to find out if there was land yet, as the rain stopped and the water started to recede, was he would the doves and ravens that you were talking about. He would send them out and see if they, I guess, reported back.
It's an inefficient method in determining whether or not the waters have gone down. He sends birds out, and that seems to be as far as he's thought. He can't see where the birds go. Otherwise, what's the point in sending them? Because you would be able to see the land. He can't train them, presumably, to bring back information. And as far as I know, unless God intervenes with the magic again, birds don't have the ability to speak. So yeah, I'm not sure the plan, but he does send the birds out in order to determine it's what he's got. You know, he's working with what he has.
So Genesis 8:5 says the mountains are visible as it recedes, but then Genesis 8:9, with the birds he lets out, they come back because there's no place for them to land. So they must not like the tops of the mountains. And maybe it's just pointy peak. And it's
very,
just too
very
hard.
Tip.
Yeah. But then in Genesis 8:11, one of the, I believe is a dove, returns with an olive leaf. And he knows now that there's exposed land. Now, the problem that I see here is it talks about when the flood comes in, everything was killed, every living thing. So this, and we would know now with the immense pressure and the lack of sunlight for over 6 months that all vegetation would have died. So this bird bringing back an olive leaf begs, you know, asks, like, from what tree did this leaf come from?
You know, in the Quran, they have a version of the Noah story. And there are some discrepancies, but when Noah sends out the raven in the Quran, it doesn't just come back without anything. It's not like it just fails and comes back. It goes out and lands on some carrion and starts eating the carrion, and Noah gets mad at it and curses it. For like getting distracted. So there are dead animals either floating on the surface of the water or lodged somewhere where the bird can indeed land.
So then this dove could have brought back an olive leaf from the flotsam and jetsam of the surface. And and then he's like, oh, good, land. it's not there yet.
Right.
Now,
we've got a comment in the chat here. Zafara says it was one continent and the mountains were not so high. They arose after the ice age, which was caused by the flood. That's a very, very interesting attempt at explaining this. Of course, we're talking about in and around the Mediterranean, and then we're talking about Mount Ararat. This is not far at all from the Himalayas. The Himalayas are the tallest mountains in the world, and they were formed when a large chunk of Africa, what we call the subcontinent of India, separated during the break apart of Pangaea, and with some force over the course of quite some time, smashed into southern Asia, becoming part of that continent, and in the process buckling all of the land in that area and forming the Himalaya mountain range.
Yeah, and in order for that, I mean, like you said, over millions of years, you can imagine the speed that the plates would have been moving if it happened over the last 4,000 years, or presumably over just a few hundred years right after the flood. too fast right. a movement.
She followed that up with, right, that happened because of the flood. So Pangaea happened because of the flood. Okay. We run into a slight problem here just because they know the name of the mountain and there was nobody around to
right.
name the mountain. It talks about what the people in the various regions knew that mountain to be named of. So before the flood, that mountain had a name for it to have had one when Noah recognized it. I know you're just playing apologist because you said it a long time ago. I'm with you. This is very, very helpful. Yeah. She's not an actual Noah believer.
yeah. Make that clear. You bring up an interesting point though, the Quran. I was wondering if they did. I'm not as familiar with the Quran, and I know it's an Abrahamic religion, and I know that they follow Jesus. So I was wondering if they had a version of the Noah's flood, the Noivian flood, I believe it's called. But was there flying horses on the ark?
Well, that is a fantastic question. The flying horse, I assume you're referencing from near the end of Muhammad's story that flies him to heaven, is not a terrestrial beast. It's supposed to be kind of like Pegasus, like the horse of the gods.
Okay.
It lives in heaven and comes down to get people.
Oh, well, sure. That makes more sense. All right.
Oh, right.
Now, okay, so the bird comes back with the olive leaf, and now he knows land. Eventually, he settles on Mount Ararat, and off they start unloading. We've made it, yay. And the first thing that Noah does is get busy sacrificing a bunch of those animals that he just saved from the flood.
It's literally the first thing he does. The boat lands, he gets out, thinks, awesome, dry land, and starts killing the animals that he's been struggling so hard to keep alive.
I think he hacks parts of the boat, right, and makes an altar.
Sure, we're not going to need that anymore.
Not going to need that anymore. But then immediately start slaughtering and burning animals, and God is pleased with the smell of the cooking meat. So, seems a little counterproductive.
Slightly counterproductive. Now, for the sake of the apologists, we should say that the traditional story is he brings the animals on board two by two, and every time you hear about or every time there's a portrayal of Noah's Ark, it's always like, you know, very, very kid friendly, like two cute little elephants going on the boat, two giraffes and two birds and two alligators and whatnot, and they're all going in just you know, like a male and a female, just that's it, going onto the boat. According to the Bible, and it's a little confusing, it does suggest that he was only taking the animals two by two if the animals were unclean. Unclean animals, even though we haven't yet gotten to the part where God says some animals are unclean, there were apparently still unclean animals. They just hadn't been defined as such yet. And unclean animals were taken on just two. Clean animals were taken on 7 by 7. Now we assume that since that would be an odd number, which isn't very helpful in procreation, that means 14 of every kind of clean animal. So you'd have 14 elephants and 14 giraffes and so forth, assuming that those are clean animals, and anything that's unclean would be the traditional 2 by 2. So you would have a couple of extras to sacrifice.
That's nice. And that helps with the space problem that they have too. So, you know, two elephants, where do you store them? 14 elephants, not a problem.
Sure.
But speaking of the clean animals, though, so in Genesis 9:3, there's this passage where God says that all the things that move on the earth, you can eat. You can use it for meat. Everything that moves, you can use it for meat. And he goes on to clarify, it seems that except for humans, you can't eat of your kind. You can't eat of other humans. He kind of puts down a law on cannibalism right there.
It's nice that post-global genocide, we do get our priorities right, and we do say that cannibalism is a no-no. I appreciate that.
But yeah, so – that's a good move on his part. It's going to help with the go forth and multiply a lot. But he says that we can eat anything that moves. And then, as you mentioned later in Leviticus, is where we start defining, no, actually, you can't.
Right. The animals were divided into clean and unclean at this point, but it also says that you can eat anything. And then once you get to Leviticus, we learn that, you've got swine, of course. I think that turtles, like sea turtles, you're not supposed to eat those. There are several other animals that are decidedly unclean, but the definitions of clean and unclean must have changed between Genesis and Leviticus.
That is, yeah. So go ahead and eat it all. Never mind, I was wrong. Sort of like, never mind, I was wrong on making you in the first place, and I needed to kill y'all. But then, so he's done his sacrifice, and it gets a little crazy there after a bit where he just, Noah just plants a vineyard and just drinks all the time, just gets drunk. We didn't really mention this. Noah was 600 years old when he built the ark. And then after the ark landed, he lived another 350 years. And he died at the ripe old age of 950 years old.
You and I haven't yet experienced this, but I've talked to people who are retired, and they often talk about how there's a listlessness. Some people who retire find that in their old age, they feel like they're not that useful anymore, and they don't know what to do, especially if they spent their whole life with a job or a career. And so many of them will find some kind of hobby or volunteer work or something that they can do in their old age, even into their 70s and maybe even 80s, they'll continue on doing this. So Noah being 600 and starting this kind of a pet project, I think, is just common sense.
It's fitting. Like, he had done the golf thing. It bored him. The time Zafara to build a really big boat.
Zafara says that if she was 600 years old, she would drink all the time too. And I will grant you that much. Yeah, 600.
Yeah,
if I'm still
true.
Around, I think wine is about the only thing I'm going to – not to mention the PTSD of, holy shit, everybody I've ever known has been brutally massacred by somebody.
I know what you're saying, and I'm with you on the drinking part, but for Noah, he had to plant a vineyard and work it, and then, you know, mash and then wait. I mean, that seems like just another big project. How are you going to relax? But he spends a lot of his time drunk and naked, and gets upset when his sons cover him up. This is why he's mad at one of them. But
yeah, he's cranky at is it Shem?
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah, because he put the he told the brothers, and then they put the blanket on him, and they put the blanket over him by like not facing him, and on like one on either side holding a blanket, and they walked backwards as the blanket covered him and dropped it, so they didn't see him naked. They were just told by the other, and that just made him really, really mad that he saw him naked, and that he told the other too. How dare you?
I mean, this is like, you know, dad. This isn't just some stranger, and he's hammered, drunk, and kind of asleep.
Right.
And then again, you just witnessed God kill everybody because of crimes against God. So I might also take the extra precaution of walking backwards in case God is
taking a shower. Yeah, I suppose. But I mean, you know, I don't want to make it weird, but I've seen my dad's penis. It just happens as you're walking around the house when you're growing up. And as far as I know, he didn't want to punish me for all eternity and my offspring and their offspring and their offspring for it. You know, it was just like, oh, he's coming out of the shower, and I was in the hallway. Oh, can't unsee that.
Your father is obviously a very wicked man.
That's true. But, right around this time is when God's making a pact with Noah. And he's saying, you know what? Sorry about that. Sorry about that whole killing everybody with the water thing. So I promise I'm never going to do that again. And to always remember that promise, I'm going to set a rainbow in the sky. So every time it rains from now on, you will see this rainbow, and it will remind you of the pact that I have with mankind moving forward, that I will never kill you guys with floods again. And I was wondering if there weren't rainbows before the flood, then it seems that when it rained, there weren't rainbows. So did light refraction work differently prior to the Nuevian flood?
Very good question. Yeah, if God puts the rainbow in the sky for a particular reason, it would certainly stand to reason that it was the first rainbow.
Yeah, must not have been so, there before.
It wouldn't have been remarkable otherwise.
Yeah, one of those.
If it's God's promise, right, then the rainbow would have, you know, especially since God is omniscient, he would know eventually I'm going to need this whole rainbow thing. So I'm not going to just, you know, no would be like, yeah, I've seen that 1,000 times. That wasn't a promise before. Yeah, it's a good point.
I think you had a couple of questions that you wanted to ask about.
Well,
logistics
logistically, okay. This is all kind of the common things. It's just laughable to me when we try to break this down and say that this all happened. Okay, you've got all these animals on the boat for at least 6 months. I've often heard that they were on the boat for a full year. What were the animals eating? Why were they not eating each other? How, once again, did they all fit on the boat? We know how big it was. The Bible, as always, breaks itself apart by trying to prove too much. It gives us the measurements, and then we're able to later figure out how many animals there are on the planet, and we can recognize that there is no way in hell you're getting even a sample of all of those animals onto this large, by our standards, granted, it's pretty big. It is not nearly big enough. Why did the animals not eat each other on the boat? Okay. The only way to explain that is, God must have stopped them from doing so.
To your point of food, Genesis 6:21, and take thou unto thee all the food that is eaten, and thou shalt gather it to thee, and it shall be for food for thee and for them. Speaking of the animals. So they were eating, and so was Noah and his family, and it was a shared food that they were both going to be using. It doesn't specify what it is, at least in this version.
So not only do we have all of these animals, but we've also brought along enough food for all of them to eat for a year, and the food doesn't get spoiled.
Right.
Okay. I mean, just for a pair of lions, you're going to need tens of thousands of pounds of meat to get them through a year on a boat. That's just one species. You got millions to go. Okay. Were the animals on the boat having sex with each other? That is, after all, why you chose them. You chose males and females in order to put them all on the boat so that they could procreate after the fact. Were they procreating? Now, Zephara says, no, see, the animals hibernated. And I've heard this argument. Not all animals hibernate. Some animals do hibernate. Even the animals that do hibernate don't hibernate for full years. A bear can hibernate for 4 to 6 months, I think. Certainly not for a full year. You have a lot of animals that don't hibernate. So we've pushed it back to the fact that they're hibernating. But the only way to get most of these animals to hibernate, and to get the ones that do hibernate to hibernate long enough, is magic.
We've got the that magic. There.
Right.
And then why bother mentioning that he's gathering food for them, unless it's for after the flood, because we know that there's no vegetation after the flood. So
there's
when
not
the
be
herbivores come
land.
Off, there's nothing for them to eat, meaning they're going to day off, meaning nothing for the predators to eat.
The answer she just typed was no, God made them hibernate and sustain them. Okay, so we've gotten it to magic. He didn't sustain them, though. He says right in Genesis, take some food, you're going to need it. Take food for you,
right.
Take food for the animals. So they are taking food for them. God's not sustaining them. He's telling Noah to prepare to sustain them. She also suggested that maybe they brought baby animals and eggs. Very, very interesting. So this would also require magic because baby animals grow up. For most animals, it doesn't take a full year for them to grow to a level of maturity that would require a full diet. Eggs hatch or they go bad. Also, how did all of the baby animals get to the ark? Did they have all of the regular animals show up and then all give birth right outside the ark? Or were they all baby animals in their home? Like the kangaroos from Australia, were they babies there and then grew up on the way to the ark? Or did a pregnant kangaroo come to the ark and then give birth just in time for the baby to get on board the ark? That also would require them to not be infants because then they would need their mother's milk and their mothers were left behind. Okay.
That's your Cameron reference.
a little bit of the Cameron. You gotta circumnavigate the Believer's Intellect in order to get all this in there. Okay, so I still haven't got an answer as to whether or not animals were procreating on the boat. Now, if they were hibernating, they wouldn't be procreating. And if they were babies, they might not be sexually mature yet. Of course, animals mature at different rates. So I've heard the argument that no, they didn't procreate. I think that there is one explanation that suggests that all of the pens on the ark had spikes pointing inward so that the animals couldn't get to each other. And that kept them physically from being able to procreate. And I suppose you could do something like that. You could keep them from procreating for the entire year. Now you already have an impossibility with how much space you need for all the animals. Now, on top of that, you're building in apparatus to separate the animals and so forth. But okay. So if they aren't procreating, what happens to animals who have a lifespan shorter than a year? What about the fruit flies and all of the other insects, most of whom live for anywhere from a couple of days to a couple of weeks, maybe a few months? They had to be procreating because they would drop dead.
That's very true. That is a very good point. I had never considered that before. And then the procreation, if the rate isn't slowed down at all or controlled by this magic that has to be in control of everything, then you're going to end up with thousands more than you started with, and there already wasn't enough room. And I also like to think of the insects. What about termites on your wooden boat?
One would think that would be a bit of a concern. You're relying on a wooden structure to survive, and you brought termites with you.
It's another idea of not great for planning.
There's a lot of problems here with the planning. How are you getting the excrement off of the boat? We have a narrative in which the entire planet is covered in water. Where did all that water come from, and where did it go away to? That was enough water to cover the tallest mountains and cover the entire planet, killing everybody there. That's a lot of water. That's
right.
So
and
much
all the water.
Water.
Yeah, all the water that's here is already here.
It's a finite resource. We've got the same amount of water. If you covered the planet in that much water, water is heavy. You would change the weight of the planet to the point of it altering its inertia around the sun.
That's something I also never considered.
It's too much weight. You have water appear out of nowhere and then disappear into nowhere. You have all of the animals coming from all over the planet, all making it to this one spot. You've got the survival of just 8 people and that being enough genetic diversity to repopulate the planet. You've got enough genetic diversity between 2 of unclean animals and 14 clean animals to repopulate the entire planet. That's an impossibility. You have nowhere near, it's laughably impossible to get this many animals onto the boat in the first place. You've got a boat that probably couldn't have been built at this time with these resources in this part of the world. Ken Ham spent over $1 million trying to recreate it, and he had modern tools and a workforce in Kentucky. Got the inability of the animals to procreate, but they had to procreate. You've got keeping them alive so that they're not eating each other during this journey. so on and so forth. What did they all drink when they got off the boat? The entire planet is covered in ocean water. There's no fresh water left.
Presumably some kind of a brackish water. The Ken Ham thing, also he would have had to have had investors, yeah?
Right, to, yeah, to collect all that money.
So when you have something like that and you're building a structure, you would have to get flood insurance on it.
Yeah. You would indeed. You said that with such a perfect tone, I didn't even notice that it was a joke there for about a count of three. That was great. The point that we're trying to demonstrate is not that God couldn't do it. It's the fact that God would have had to have done it. So God, at this point, you can't explain all of these things using science. In fact, there is this weird combination of, well, we can prove it, we can prove it, we can prove it. No, you can't. Well, where we can't, God intervened. Very well. Then you've pushed it all the way back to all of this actually happened in the real world, and God kept the planet from falling into the sun or leaving its orbit because of the extra weight. He disappeared the water and wished it into being. He kept all the animals from eating and fucking each other on the boat, so on and so forth. He was like the TARDIS. He made the inside of the ark bigger than the outside of the ark to fit all of the animals. It's all magic, 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 in which case, why did God bother with all of the technicalities of making him build a sound, seaworthy boat and using a flood to kill everybody? If you're going to use magic to suspend the laws of nature 14, 15 times in order to make this entire orchestra all work, why not just kill everyone?
Why not just disappear? If you don't even have to kill them, just make them not there anymore. Gone. And why didn't he know this was going to be the case beforehand? Anyway, everybody, that's the topic. So if you would please interact with me throughout the rest of this week and early into next week, up until the show Wednesday, on Twitter at El Buterino, and let me know your thoughts on the Nuevian flood. If you can defend it, please do. If you have more questions about it, please ask. Let's get the conversation going. Corey, do you have anything else?
That just about does it for me as well. This was so much. I can tell already that ISM moving forward is going to be a lot of fun with Scott on board. We're going to do some more of these. They'll be a lot shorter during future episodes. We are going to do an episode on Wednesday, and this is a bit of an introduction piece. Our episode on Wednesday will be at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. It will be scoped. You'll be able to listen to it here as well. The subject of this Wednesday's episode will be sin. We're doing a full two-hour broadcast on the narrative of sin. It's going to be a lot of fun. We encourage everybody to join us for that. If you're enjoying the show, if you're getting entertainment, education, whatever out of this, we encourage you to go to patreon.com/informed podcast. Give us a couple of bucks per episode. We sure do appreciate that. Follow us on Twitter, ISM podcast_. He is Scott L. Deuterino. I am Corey at Dopinephrine. See you on Wednesday.